Lots of moving parts in downtown Jacksonville, including the hunt on now for JEA's new downtown headquarters. We'll tell you all about it. Good Thursday morning. We're live from Studio 5. This is First Coast Connect, and I'm Melissa Ross. Thanks for listening. And just ahead, JEA officials announced their shortlist of potential new sites earlier this week. Some of them may surprise you. We're talking about development in the urban core this morning, and we want your calls. Call us up right now, 549-2937. Then later, it's a new science history play about one of the great scientists of the 20th century. You probably haven't heard about her, though, because she was a woman. We'll tell you about Photograph 51. All of that ahead, including our preview of The Jackson tonight at WJCT Studios, too. That's all coming up. But first this hour, could the city's JEA Tower and all of its employees be moving east, right next to where the Jaguars play? Yeah, TIAA Bank Field. That's apparently one of the sites JEA is considering as it looks to move its downtown corporate headquarters. And that's just part of the news happening this week as we look at a lot of moving parts in the city's urban core. Downtown development is all over the place. Here with more on that, someone who tracks it every single day, David Cotton, associate editor with the Jax Daily Record. He's in studio now. Good morning.
Good morning.
And congrats on a recent promotion, by the way.
Oh, thank you so much.
And it's 549-2937 as we talk about downtown development. What are your thoughts and comments about all the projects happening around the city, whether it's on the South Bank, the North Bank, the Laura Street Trio, JEA's moves, or more? Give us a call, 549-2937. Send your emails to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org, tweets to @MelissaInJax, or weigh in on Facebook. Okay, let's begin with JEA, which has been making news over and over again for the last year or so. The other day, they announced their shortlist of potential locations for their new corporate headquarters. What are the three sites? Where is JEA moving potentially, David?
Well, there are three sites, as you said. The first one would be sort of next to or at their current headquarters. So we're not sure if that would be a redevelopment or just building a new tower somewhere around there in the urban core. The other part is kind of interesting. It's over near Kings Avenue Station. Developer Mike Belenke owns the property over there, and that would be certainly a move from the North Bank to the South Bank over there. But I guess the one that's catching all of the headlines would be as part of Lot J, which is part of Shad Khan and his development company, Iguana, and his partners, the Cordish Companies. They would like to have JEA as their corporate anchor.
And so it would be right next to the football stadium, would anchor this massive new development that's planned.
Yes.
Can you paint a picture for us if let's assume that that's where JEA will probably end up going, since Shad Khan swings a heavy bat with city and business leaders in Jacksonville. So let's say JEA is situated there in Lot J, just to the left of TIAA Bank Field. What else will we be seeing there if this whole development Khan has envisioned comes to life?
Well, this would be part of the first phase, and that would include an office tower. It would include a large parking structure to be built over one of the retention ponds over there, a hotel, what is called a live entertainment venue. That's Cordish's brand of sort of a smaller than Daly's Place entertainment venue. They'd like some restaurants over there, some retail. It would sort of take up what is now the parking lots between Daly's Place and First Coast News over there. It would be that first phase. The reason that is the start of this whole thing is because we have a year or so before construction even begins on the Hart Bridge ramps. And so any talk of the shipyards or Metropolitan Park, that's going to wait until Lot J is developed.
So the idea is to develop Lot J, then, and that would be starting next year. Then in 2020, the plan is to demolish the ramps that come off the Hart Bridge and sort of zoom past Everbank Field and kind of dump out into downtown. They want to get rid of those ramps altogether so that they can further develop what is currently Metropolitan Park and the shipyards, which is a big open lot.
Yeah, and so this is really the long play for Shad Khan. He knows that, you know, the city over the summer kind of squash this idea of building a convention center, you know, in the next 18 months. So that gives him a little bit more time. And I think it gives him a heads up, a leg up rather, to actually getting a convention center down near his stadium. The idea is to create sort of this entertainment neighborhood. I mean, it's not so far-fetched when you think about it, because there is, you know, we've got an arena there, a baseball field, baseball stadium. There's plans to redevelop the Duro Fixtures building over there next to Intuition. The idea is to sort of create this neighborhood over there. Now, the downside to that is, you know, ironically, we're talking about infill development downtown. You're talking about moving 836 or so employees away from the urban core that right. really needs this infill.
Yeah. So is this a good idea? Not only in terms of moving the employees out of downtown, but also, is it smart to put the utility on a site that's going to need a lot of remediation and is close to water? It's very close to the St. John's River. We saw the potential of flooding along the riverbank. Is the board of JEA looking at any of those concerns?
Well, if they are, we're not sure, because unfortunately with this whole process, the only things we know about any of these developments is the name of the group that's doing it and the proposed location. Because of their procurement code, they keep everything sort of to themselves. So those are really important questions, though, that hopefully before February 5th, when the board meets again to sort of see these presentations in person, we'll get some of those answers, because I think that's very important. We've gone through two major hurricanes in the last 3 years, and one that did substantial damage to the downtown and downtown neighborhoods. And I think there's a lot of heartburn with people who are saying, look, why would you build something closer to the river, especially the utility company that is charged with, you know, fixing and getting people back online and getting their power back on? Why would you make it harder? Who knows what they're going to do, though, to try to, you know, beef up that area.
It's certainly a move that would be heavily criticized for that reason alone. And then also, David, if the utility does move to Lot J, it will also feed a narrative that has really taken hold in this community that the JEA board is not operating in a transparent way, that it's beholden to whether it's a corporate leader or the mayor, dancing to the tune of the city's oligarchs and power players, that it's not necessarily making decisions that are best for ratepayers and the general public. That is certainly the perception.
Yeah, certainly the perception of some. There are others, though, that think, yeah, this is a great idea to sort of get this stadium complex going and making it a year-round attraction and to have a corporate anchor. And whether that's JEA or not, Lot J is going to happen. And whether or not JEA is the corporate anchor, there's going to be somebody that's going to move there. And, you know, so you have people who work, live, and play right there, you know. It's sort of the Disney effect, and I think that's what Shad Khan really wants to establish down there by Lot J.
Whether JEA goes to Lot J or another location, local outlets, including your own, have also reported on the fact that in this vetting process, there hasn't been much consideration given to the safety of any of these locations when it comes to storm surge, climate change impacts. JEA doesn't seem to be putting that near the top of its list.
Now, part of their requirements for these companies to, you know, they all, you know, during over the summer, since October, essentially, they asked these companies to submit their bids. And I believe there is a part about that in their packages. The problem is we don't know what's in those packages. So how are they addressing these issues is going to be extremely important. Now, look, Cordish companies, you know, these guys are international developers. They don't just throw stuff out there. They want to make sure they build something that lasts, because ultimately they want to make money on it. But again, I think it's going to be a hard sell for the public at some point. Not only because of that, but because you're moving employees away from the urban core when you really need that density down there.
They spend money during the day at lunch and in the shops. That's sort of the thinking. Get more people in there during the day.
Yeah, and it's a public utility company that is right around the corner from City Hall. So it's very easy for the CEO of JEA to go to City Council right now if he has to be summoned to talk in front of them, or if there's, you know, business that needs to get done. Why would you separate that? Now, again, this is not set in stone. There are two other proposals out there, one that would keep them in the urban core, the other would move them to the South Bank. But gosh, it's, you know, I wouldn't be surprised if in 2 months, Melissa, we're talking about, hey, Lot J is going to be the place where, you know, JEA moves.
Yeah. At the same time, we've known for some time that it's an older building and not suited to the 21st century needs of the utility. So
it's too big, too.
Yeah. Okay. Let's go to your calls now. It's 549-2937. So what do you think? Is it a mistake to site JEA along the river, another government building on the river, when, you know, Jacksonville is trying to get away from that historic trend? 549-2937. Tom is on the west side. Hi, Tom. Good morning.
Oh, good morning to y'all, too. Well, first off, I thought we'd learned our lesson about putting city buildings on the river and losing our tax revenue in that. And second, I'm kind of dubious of the whole idea of moving when the rationale is we need a new building because we didn't take care of the old one.
Well, okay, thanks, Tom.
It's not necessarily that they didn't take care of the new one, but the old building is just very antiquated. It's way too big for JEA's footprint. Now, keep in mind, Lot J is owned by the city of Jacksonville. So, I mean, JEA is not paying property taxes where they're at. They're likely not going to pay property taxes wherever they go.
We're getting emails asking people about that. Will they pay property taxes at this new location?
Now, I mean, again, it is city-owned property. Now, keep in mind, JEA does represent a huge amount of, at least a percentage of the annual budget. They do contribute about $100 million every year to the general fund budget.
And of course, that was part of the argument not to privatize JEA, which was another big controversy over the last year. People spoke out loud and clear, the public did, and said, we don't want this utility privatized. And the argument to keep it in public hands is the amount it contributes to the city's general fund. That was part of the argument anyway.
Yes, at least one.
All right. And we are talking all about downtown development, JEA potentially moving next to the bank, and all of your questions about everything that's happening downtown with David Cotton of the Daily Record. We'll talk about some other projects in a moment, but let's get a few more of your calls on the air right now at 549-2937. Jack is in East Arlington. Hi, Jack. Good morning.
Good morning. Good morning. The question I had was, so you're going to take down the ramps to the bridge, so I guess everybody's going to come off the Hart Bridge into the kind of dump into downtown Jacksonville from the bridge, or are they going to build different ramps that take you wherever they're going to take you to after taking down ramps that are there for get people out of downtown?
Sure. Yeah, let's talk about that, Jack. Jack, thanks for that call. By the way, we've just no scientific or data-driven evidence, but just my very unscientific impression of the whole thing with the Hart Bridge ramps, judging by calls to this and emails to this program, not everyone's on board with that idea. A lot of folks like those ramps, but they are from another era. Mm-hmm. They do impede the growth that is planned, and so they are set to come down. Now, let's explain how the traffic flow will work, David, once they do come down.
Yes. So when you come, say you're coming into downtown from the Hart Bridge, you will land right about, right actually near here, the entrance to WJCT studios here. The plan is to actually widen Gatorville Boulevard to increase that capacity. And then, so it's about a 3/4 mile stretch. Right past where Intuition Ale Works is right now, A. Philip Randolph, those ramps leading into downtown, so the ones that go to, you know, past the jail and past the Veterans Memorial Arena, those are going to stay. You'll still have access to go straight to Bay Street, but it's only just one little section. They are going to increase the capacity. They think there's an opportunity to really, you know, make it a little bit more walkable too, make wider sidewalks, and just increase the capacity there. And, you know, the city's official line is that it will help traffic to the Talleyrand Port area.
So there will be a little bit of overhead ramp left.
Yes, and that'll be past A. Philip Randolph Boulevard. So that'll be the four sort of arteries that go into, I believe it's you know, Duval and Monroe Streets, I think, as well. There's two others. I don't have them off the top of my head, but the ones that are there that people use to sort of get out of the core onto those expressway ramps, those will remain, and they'll, but you know, you'll kind of come up and come down. It'll be like a roller coaster.
Interesting. Okay. 549-2937. Lane is in Springfield. Hi, Lane. Good morning.
Hi, good morning. How are you?
Okay, thanks. Thanks for calling.
You're welcome. My main concern is, you know, the city of Jacksonville's determination to put non-taxpaying entities on our river. We're close to the river. You know, we're the only major city in the world with a beautiful natural resource like the St. John's River, where we have the school board, city hall. Well, we used to have city hall on the river. JEA and tons of parking, which is such a waste when we've got this gorgeous river that the city insists on putting, you know, buildings that will not be paying taxes on.
Lane, thanks so much for that call. And let's bring up the big picture of her point. Now, over the weekend, the old City Hall annex was demolished to great fanfare. It's on the river. That's where City Hall used to be. Next door to it is the old Duval County Courthouse. That is also set to come down soon. And presumably private buildings, tax-paying buildings will go there. But she's right. The jail is on the river. Until very recently, those other government buildings were on the river. The school board building on the South Bank is on the river. And it, it really is remarkable to look at that. So, let's talk about the plan to further develop the river and why that has been so difficult for this city over the years.
And sort of just to clarify, you know, Lot J is not directly on the banks of the St. John's River. There's parkland there. But I get the point that you've got a jail there. And the reason these buildings were there is in the past, it was to spur economic development. You know, you put something there and hopefully, private companies come in there and develop. The school board is a completely separate agency, so the city doesn't really have jurisdiction over what they do with their property, although I think a lot of people would love them to move off the river. There's not really a reason for them to be there, sandwiched in between the district and all these other condos.
Right, this new South Bank development, the district is going in next to that building. But, you know, her point, I think, is a good one. When you go to other cities, when you go to, say, Cincinnati, Ohio, or even San Antonio, Texas, which has this little creek, literally this little trickle of water that runs through its downtown, and they have developed it beautifully. And we have, in Jacksonville, Florida, this incredible, beautiful, wide river that flows through downtown. And no offense to any one entity or person or official, we haven't done a good job of making the most of this natural resource. No, just have not done a good job.
Well, especially on the North Bank. On the South Bank, yes, there's been a lot more development. You know, you've got a great hospital complex. You've got the condos there. But people like Lori Boyer, who's a city council member, look, even the mayor's office, they are certainly, I mean, there's a reason these buildings are coming down over there on the riverfront. They want that property developed.
Sure.
And, people will say, well, why are we spending money to tear them down when a developer could? Well, if a developer was going to tear them down, they would have torn them down. This is another block that you get out of the way for a development company to say, hey, here's a blank piece of property. Do what you want. Let the market demand what will be successful.
No firm plans, though, for the City Hall Annex and the old courthouse site.
Well, not yet.
There's nothing set yet as to what will go there.
No. We had these talks earlier in the summer about a convention center that is scrapped. It's just a blank slate right now.
And that's really because, isn't it, as you mentioned a minute ago, David, because Shad Khan wants a convention center near the football stadium.
That is the theory that is certainly going on Twitter right now.
Okay. Regina is in Mandarin. Regina, you're on the air. Good morning.
Good morning, Melissa. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Just a quick comment. With all the talk of development in that area, I would hate to see the river run, the 15K national championship changed. That's my only comment. You know, Jacksonville's known for their river run. And if all that development precludes running the river run there, I'd hate to see that change. And I agree that the decisions are made in very few people's hands. And it's just taken the direction of the city in a different way. That's all. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah, bye. Thank you.
Yeah, she brings up an interesting point there. The Gate River Run obviously goes over the Hart Bridge. I'm not sure exactly how that's going to be impacted. I'm sure it'll be impacted just like traffic will be impacted there for a few months. But, keep in mind, change is difficult for a lot of people. And I understand the heartburn there, but you also sort of have to look at the other side of the coin. The state thought this was a good idea. The federal government thought this was a good idea. And so there's some momentum behind it.
Mark is in St. Augustine. Hi, Mark. Good morning to you.
Hey, good morning. I was just curious if there was any consideration to moving the headquarters into maybe an underdeveloped section of Jacksonville, like the Northwest Quadrant, or maybe over into Arlington.
Thanks, Mark.
Short answer, no. JEA's board of directors was very adamant that they wanted to remain part of the downtown fabric. They feel like it's central to everything. Although it's funny you mentioned that, Mark, because on our Facebook page, we've had people say, hey, there's a big old mall in Regency Square that's dying right now.
That's right.
Could use a corporate anchor there. And then, as you said, the Northwest Quadrant. But no, unfortunately, they're going to stay somewhere in downtown.
Okay. David Cotton has some other news and notes that are appearing in this week's Daily Record. Some other interesting projects have caught your eye. Can you share?
Yeah. Earlier this week, the guys who were developing the Old Ambassador Hotel there on Julia Street, this is a beautiful property that, you know, has just been neglected for a long time. They got some incentives from the city. They are going to redevelop the Ambassador Hotel into a La Quinta Inn and Suites. Okay, I know what you're thinking. La Quinta? La Quinta was purchased by another hotel brand recently. I'm not sure exactly when. They've refreshed their brand, so it's actually going to be a lot nicer than you think. And then they're also building 220, you know, apartments right there, brand new apartments, some infill. Again, it's ironic we're talking about a big employer leaving when you've got all these other infill projects going on in downtown.
Right. So in addition to that, other affordable housing projects are also moving forward in La Villa, apartments that are not too overpriced, in keeping with this idea of getting more people living in the urban core.
Yeah, Vestcor has done a pretty good job over there of building these affordable and workforce housing. Now, those are just terms for, income thresholds. So, you know, for the person who's, you know, not making six figures working downtown, you know, there's a lot of people who work downtown who want to live near downtown, but can't afford to live in these, you know, high priced, quote unquote, luxury apartments. They're building their third project, lofts at Jefferson Station. I drive by it every day, and that's going to be workforce and affordable. It's going to be great. They do actually a really good job over there.
Let's take one more call. It's Bob in Lakewood. Hi, Bob. Good morning to you.
Hi, and good morning to you, and thank you for the call.
Sure.
I'm wondering why JEA cannot stay where it is or build on adjacent property there downtown, remaining in the city. There's a parking lot. There's the Salvation Army. They have a facility already adjacent. That's my question.
Yeah, sure. Okay, right. Okay, so with all of the other sites they could have chosen.
Well, that is one of the sites. The Ryan Companies US is one of the three finalists, and that would include them either building right next door to their current tower mm-hmm. or redeveloping. Again, we don't have the details because they haven't released them, but yes, that would keep them in the urban core. That is one of the things. I hope before February 5th, we get our hands on these packets and we can have a little bit more detail for your viewer, for our, you know, your callers.
Absolutely. Us as well. We did reach out to JEA and they told us that they are in what is called a quiet period.
Yes. The cone of silence is what they call it.
A cone of silence, if you will, about these plans. Although more will be learned at their February 5th board meeting. At the same time, some high profile names on the JEA board have handed in their resignations as well. Let's mention that quickly.
Hussein Cumber, who's been on the board since 2014, is stepping down. His wife, Leanna, has been elected to city council. And so to avoid any conflicts of interest, Mr. Cumber is stepping down from the board. Also, very noteworthy is Alan Howard, who is the chair of the board, told me after Tuesday's board meeting that he will not seek reappointment. Both of those men have been sort of steady hands on that board. And so it will be interesting to see what happens in the next year because JEA is going to undergo some changes, especially with the new headquarters. Who knows if this privatization debate comes up after the elections or next summer? Who knows? But there's going to be new leadership on the board level, and they're losing a lot of institutional knowledge later this year, for sure.
Thanks so much, David Cotton, Associate Editor with the Jax Daily Record. Thanks for being here.
My pleasure.
Much more still ahead later. The top five things you should have on your radar this weekend, including the Jackson, here tonight at WJCT. But up next, celebrating the life and work of one of the 20th century's most influential scientists. It's a name you've never heard of, but we'll tell you about her next. This is First Coast Connect on 89.9. Back in a moment. Well, it is a riveting and little-known story of one of the great female scientists of the 20th century and the tragically overlooked role she played in the discovery of the double helix. Rosalind Franklin was instrumental in the discovery of DNA, perhaps the most important scientific discovery of the last 100 years, but her achievements never got the proper credit. The male scientists of her era who published their findings on DNA took credit for her work and they dismissed her important role in the discovery. That is being rectified now, though, with a new production telling Franklin's story. It debuts this weekend at the Museum of Science and History. It's called Photograph 51. Performer Karen Konzen stars in the show as Rosalind Franklin and joins us now in studio. Good morning.
Good morning.
Thanks for being with us. And
Thank you.
I have to tell you, as I heard about this, I was excited and at the same time I was angry because this incredible woman never got her due, which is so often the case with a female historical figure. So tell me a little bit about Rosalind Franklin. Introduce her to us. Who was she?
Rosalind Franklin was a British scientist who had made her kind of name very well known as an X-ray crystallographer. And she had done a lot of work specifically looking at the structure of coal and had become very well recognized in her field for that. Was really considered one of the probably the top X-ray crystallographer at her time. And she was working in France in the 1950s and was offered a position at King's College in London. She originally went there under the auspice that she would have her own lab and get to do her own work. But once she got there, she was a little surprised to find out she'd been assigned to be an assistant to a male scientist, Dr. Wilkins, and he wanted her to work on DNA rather than her own work.
And so she did.
So she did, yes.
And then what happened?
She took a photograph of a DNA molecule that is in the name of the title of the play, Photograph 51, which showed distinctly that DNA is structured as a double helix. Now, the reason this is important is, I mean, DNA, we all know what it is now. We all can get our little kits. We can swap our cheeks and send them out and learn about our genes and where we're from on the planet.
The human genome.
Exactly. And but that how that actually worked and functioned was not understood at the time. People knew that there was this stuff called DNA, but there was no proof that that's where our genes lived. The way to prove that was to find out the structure of DNA. And so her photograph definitively showing what that structure was, that it was a double helix, is what unlocked what Watkins and Wilkins and so many other people have now called the secret to life.
So why didn't she get the credit?
There's a little bit of a dispute over exactly what happened, but essentially, she was a very an extremely analytical person. Once she had that photograph, she didn't just kind of rush off to publish the information. It was important to her that she was very, very meticulous in making sure all of her calculations were correct, that what she was seeing was really what she thought it was. So she kind of sat on it and studied it and continued to work on it. At some point during that time, Wilkins, who she was working with, either gave or showed or thieved, depending on who's telling the story, a copy of that image, photograph 51, to Drs. Watson and Crick at Cambridge. They then built a model of DNA based on her image without ever giving her any credit for having taken the image initially. And their model then proved to be correct.
Why didn't Rosalind Franklin protest, try to get her name included in this massively important discovery?
I mean, probably a few reasons. One is that she was actually quite ill at the time. She had been diagnosed with ovarian cancer, probably and speculatively because of her prolonged exposure to x-rays during her work. Another thing is she actually published at the same time. So in the same issue, the same journal, Watson and Crick had published their idea of DNA. Her paper with her findings were behind theirs. So the way the journal was organized is it made it look like her evidence was just supporting theirs. So she did
when
publish.
It was actually the other way around to a
yes.
degree. Okay.
Yes.
Was it just the sexism of the era that denied her due?
A good bit of it was. It's definitely a hard time to be a woman in science in the 1950s. There were extremely few women doing it at that time. And you had to really fight for your position to be there and to fight to be recognized, fight to really have your work recognized as being on the same level as your male counterparts. By all accounts, though, she was also not a really good collaborator. And that probably also didn't play well for her in terms of being able to work with the other people around her in that kind of collaborative effort.
And science is collaborative. So certainly that's important. Now, mm-hmm. that's something that you relate to personally as you star in this production, because not only are you an actress, you have an advanced degree in molecular biology?
Just biology, yes.
In biology. You are also at the Mayo Clinic. Mm-hmm. And so for you, you understand, I think, at a really deep level what it's like to be a woman in science. How did this resonate with you?
I mean, it's really exciting for me to get to do, kind of marry up my two loves. I've always adored science and the discovery of it, and it's exciting. And to be able to marry that up with theater, I think there's just not enough science out there on stage and storytelling that way. But yeah, I have played a scientist in real life too. Mm-hmm. a master's in biology, and I spent most of my science career working in the field of molecular biology and genetics.
When you were in graduate school, you found out that you almost didn't get a summer internship that was an important opportunity for mm-hmm. you. And your advisor said, don't worry about it. The man that is making the decision just doesn't like women. Mm. So that is something that stuck with you. Is that right?
Yeah, absolutely. I wasn't sure whether I was more frustrated by the idea I didn't almost get an internship just because I was female or because I was being told not to worry about it. On the one hand, I was somewhat relieved that it wasn't something I had done because that was my first reaction, that I had actually done something wrong. I think a lot of women have that initial reaction when they hear something like this. They assume it's, well, I did something wrong in the lab or I made a mistake. But to find that out that wasn't the case, in some ways a relief, but also angering at the same time.
It was just misogyny
that
held you back. And yeah.
Luckily I did get the internship.
And it
turned
get
out
it.
I did. And
okay,
it worked out really well. I had a really great experience.
That's good. And so that's positive. And what's positive too is that people can learn more about Rosalind Franklin, who honestly was as significant a figure as Madame Curie mm-hmm. or other figures of that level of renown. She should be that well known.
Absolutely. Watson said, and I agree with him on this particular point, that DNA cannot be underrated. And her contribution to that discovery and characterization of it absolutely cannot be underrated.
It's interesting to note that at the Eagle Pub in Cambridge, where all this scientific work was done, there is a plaque on the wall commemorating Watson's account of the discovery of DNA. But apparently, just a few years ago, someone used a magic marker to add the name Rosalind Franklin yes. to this official plaque. What do you think about that?
I think it's very clever and well-earned. I also have heard, I've seen elsewhere that they have kind of updated some of the information inside the pub to include her as well. But yeah, it's symptomatic, I think, of the lack of recognition that she received and many other female scientists of that time period.
Now, is this a one-woman show that
Not
you're doing?
Not at all.
Not at all.
Not at all. I am extremely lucky and grateful to have some fabulous other cast members. We have Rich Pentello and Christopher Watson, Josh Taylor, Mr. Wall, all playing other characters in this tale of Watson and Crick and Wilkins. We also have two of the student, one of the students that Dr. Franklin mentored, and another colleague, Dr. Caspar.
This is debuting tomorrow night at MOSH, the Museum of Science and History. Two shows, Friday and Saturday night. It's a play by Anna Ziegler called Photograph 51, The Story of Rosalind Franklin and Her Pivotal Role in the Discovery of DNA, the Double Helix. This is really cool. Go see this play because you will also be able to check out the museum. Star Karen Konzen is here now. And thanks again so much, Karen, for sharing this with us. Go to actorscollective.com for more and tickets. Break a leg.
Thank you.
And up next, more ideas for your weekend, including our own The Jackson here at WJCT. That's right after this. Welcome back. Come on out to WJCT Studios tonight. We've got a special event planned. It's called The Jackson. Getting there in Jacksonville. Is getting there tough for you? It is for me sometimes. So I think so many people will be interested in this. Our news director, Jessica Palumbo, is here with more. Hey, good morning.
Good morning, Melissa. We are hosting our second ever event under the banner of The Jackson, which is WJCT's partnership with Modern Cities. For those of you who don't know, The Jackson, we have a segment that runs Thursday mornings here on 89.9. We have a website, thejackson.org. And then we have these live events where we invite you to come out and interact with people who are making decisions about planning the future of Jacksonville. Tonight's event is about transportation. Mm-hmm. So the name getting there, of course, physically getting from here to there. But it's also like, we're getting there. We're like not there yet. We're getting there in Jacksonville.
So are we there yet, Mom? Yeah, we're not there yet. And that in terms of better transportation hubs, better transportation options, we're going to learn what's planned, though, right?
Yes. We're looking at how the changing demographics of Jacksonville specifically, because Jacksonville is a rapidly changing area. The metro area is one of the fastest growing in the nation, especially in the suburbs, the exurbs of Jacksonville. And in Jacksonville itself, it's becoming a much more diverse place. So does that mean that we might need more public transportation options in these denser areas of town that aren't getting a lot of attention? Of course, we have really big ticket projects that we hear a lot about in transportation, the automated vehicles, and we will have an automated vehicle here at WJCT for people to get a demonstration.
That's cool.
So that'll be in the building when you come on in and you can see how that works. That's going to be one of the possible replacements for the Skyway system. We're also going to be talking about questions like what does transportation equity look like? So when we're talking about is transportation available equally to everybody, does everybody have good options?
Interesting. And in addition to the autonomous vehicles, which mm-hmm. we will be seeing on our roads sooner than people think. There's a new transportation hub being built west of downtown that will integrate the city's bus lanes, the city's mm-hmm. skyway, and other avenues of transportation. Will we learn more about that?
Absolutely. That's over in La Villa. That's across from the Prime Osborne Convention Center, of course. And we'll be hearing from Brad Thoborn, who was with JTA as a strategic planning director for a long time and still works with a lot of the projects that they have. We'll hear from Jacoby Pittman, who is the city councilwoman over in La Villa. We'll hear from Justin Dennis, who is the owner of a company called Urban SDK, which is working with data and making smart streets. And what is a smart street and a complete street? We'll hear about all of these terms that planners like to throw around and what do they mean for the future of Jacksonville.
This is so important to so many people because we are the largest city in the country in terms of land mass. And we are still a city that's pretty much still largely dependent on the car.
Right.
And that has become a big pain point for this city. We're just not set up for the kind of public transit that older northern cities have all laid out in a grid-like sort of fashion.
Yeah.
And so the tension between what people want and what's possible, that I think will be the energy around this discussion, won't it?
That's right. Yeah, the conversation isn't just rah-rah, let's talk about fun new projects in the future, but also these real challenges that we have. We talked about social equitable access to transportation. What are complete streets? What is transit-oriented development? How do we respond to these population shifts that we're seeing? How do autonomous vehicles and bike share fit into that? Does bike share even work in a city like Jacksonville? Bike share has its own issues in other places and has been called even racist in some areas. So we're going to be that is a question for our panelist Ennis Davis, who is one of the co-founders of Modern Cities, and he thinks a lot about these issues as a transportation planner in his day job and how these things relate to issues of race and equality. So I think that'll be a really interesting intersection of the conversation that we'll hear tonight. And we invite you to come and invite and ask your questions directly to these experts. That's part of the program. So it's a conversation among the experts, but then at the end, there's a Q&A for the audience to talk directly to them.
And this is free, by the way.
Yes.
So come on down to WJCT tonight at 6:00. It's the Jackson, Getting There in Jacksonville. 6 to 9 p.m., free to the public, but it's first come, first serve. Our studio can't hold a lot of people, but at a certain point, they will close the doors. You can learn so much about this and check out a new autonomous vehicle we'll have on display right here in the building.
Please register at wjct.org/events.
Jessica Palumbo, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
Again, that's tonight. A quick break and some other ideas for your weekend. We'll have Carrie Speckman's Top 5 right after this. This is First Coast Connect on 89.9. Don't go away.
First Coast teachers join WJCT and ViStar Credit Union for the 6th Annual Teach Conference, a day to engage, empower, and inspire. Featured keynote speakers are Wes Moore and Hamish Brewer. Educators will present breakout sessions and share best practices on topics such as equity, classroom management, and technology. Attendees will enjoy breakfast, lunch, a swag bag, and so much more on Saturday, March 2nd at the Hyatt Hotel. Find more information at wjct.org/.
Finds and installs residential and commercial solar electric systems. NABCET certified A1A Solar provides sustainable and financially efficient energy solutions. Learn whether solar is right for you with a 5-question quiz at a1asolar.com.
Jacksonville Magazine's second annual Jacksonville Lantern Parade is Saturday, February 16th. The illuminated celebration of creativity, music, kids, and the St. John's River is open to the public. Participants should bring something that glows, twinkles, or shines. More at JacksonvilleLanternParade.com.
Transportation planners want to make downtown streets smarter, but what does that mean? How can data improve our commutes? hear from some of the people shaping our transportation future, and ask them your questions at a free Jackson event here at WJCT January 24th. Getting There in Jacksonville is moderated by me, Jessica Palumbo. Register now at wjct.org/events.
Support for the Jackson on WJCT comes from the Jacksonville Police and Fire Pension Fund.
Australian festival goers in recent months have taken contaminated ecstasy pills, and some have died. An Australian politician advocates for testing pills to let people know if they can be taken safely.
It's a harm reduction approach instead of a zero tolerance approach.
Kate Fairman has taken the party drug herself, and she's changing the conversation about recreational drugs in Australia. She's on The World this afternoon at 3 on 89.9 WJCT.
Should governments pay ransom to terrorists? U.S. policy has been firm. We do not negotiate. But countries like Germany, France, and Spain do, and they've secured the release of their citizens. Reporter Joel Simon has worked on dozens of hostage cases. He says no one should die for a policy that does not work. We'll hear why next time on 1A.
Today at 10 on 89.9 WJCT.
Welcome back. Finally, this hour, it's time for the countdown. The Spectator is here with her look at the top five things to
Yay,
do this weekend.
I loved that music.
Yes, time to count them down, baby.
That was super cool.
Yes. So what are your top five, Carrie?
Top five. Number five, the Old City Pirate Fest, which is taking place Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. As you know, St. Augustine, long history with pirates.
Sure.
Since like the 1500s. But now we're celebrating pirates who used to come and pillage and sack the town.
Now they're beloved local characters.
Exactly. So it's a three-day festival, all things pirate. They have food, drink, kids area, sword demonstrations, magicians, puppet shows.
This is fun, and this is coming up all this weekend, Friday through Sunday, in the historic district on St. George Street. In St. Augustine.
The Colonial Quarter.
The Colonial Quarter.
To be specific.
Yeah. Talk like a pirate, too, when you go down to the Old City Pirate Fest. Matey.
Ahoy.
Ahoy. Okay. That's number five. Number four. Mapping Our Past, Saturday at the Main Library.
That was cool.
What's going on at the library?
At the library, well, they're celebrating the Louis Anspacher map collection, but they're having a really cool day of map-related activities. Christopher Lane, who was a map and print expert on PBS Antique Roadshow for 21 years, is going to talk about the geographic myths of the Southeast. Like, there were maps that had imaginary mountains and non-existent bodies of water.
Interesting.
They're also going to have local antique appraisers that will give you a free on-site evaluation of your treasure. Two per person, please. And a panel discussion about the role of maps in Jacksonville city planning.
Very nice. This is a great event.
And kids
don't
activities.
Overlook this. This is free, too.
No, it sounds super, super fun.
Yeah, this is interesting. It's Mapping Our Past, Saturday at the Main Library, 11 to 4. That's free. Okay.
Hooray!
Number three, Howie Mandel coming to town.
This music is cracking me up.
This is all for you, baby. Okay, tell me about this one.
All right, well, of course, people know him from America's Got Talent, where he's a judge and he's the host of Deal or No Deal, but he's actually been a comedian for like 30 years.
Oh, yeah, he's been around
Remember
forever.
Remember when he would take the rubber glove and put it over his head and inflate it? And anyway, so he's back to doing his stand-up thing. And, oh, he's also on St. Elsewhere, for anyone
I remember
who remembers
that
show in the 80s.
Now, he's also known for being a germaphobe. He won't shake hands with anybody.
That's correct. He will fist bump.
Yeah, he fist bumps everybody. So
yes.
Go see Howie Mandel. That is Sunday at Thrasher Horn in Orange Park. Okay, number two. I'm enjoying this.
I know. It's fun.
The Many Faces of Breast Cancer, Saturday at Cork Studios in Riverside. This is a fundraiser.
It's a fundraiser for the Donna Foundation, and it centers around breast cancer survivors. Laura Evans, who's an awesome local photographer and a close personal friend, she shot photos of survivors, like men and women, survivors of breast cancer. And it's an event to raise money, obviously, and awareness. And they'll have hors d'oeuvres, drinks, live music.
Sure. Saturday night at Cork in Riverside, tickets are being sold in advance. Go on out, support the Donna Foundation, and support Cork. Okay, and now we make our way number one. Old 97s and Shooter Jennings.
Yeah. I don't know if you were familiar with Old 97s.
Sure.
I love them. They are kind of alt country pioneers. They're going to be performing their rootsy rock with their punk energy. They are touring in support of a new album. And then Shooter Jennings.
Waylon Jennings' son.
Yes, who's kind of the outlaw country southern rock guy. They're co-headlining. I'm not really sure what that means, but...
Hey, it'll be a good show either way.
It'll be an awesome show. It's at the Ponte Vedra Concert Hall.
That's Saturday night at the Ponte Vedra Concert Hall. And so there you go. No shortage of really exciting
and varied events. It's so hard to pick five things. There's so many things.
It's hard to narrow it down, but that is the Spectator's top five. Go to thespectator.com if you missed one. And always good to see you, my friend.
Pleasure and an inconvenience.
That's our show. Thanks so much for listening. Thanks to all of our guests and callers, too. Our producer is Heather Schatz. Michelle Corum is our director. We always want your feedback. Send your emails to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. And if you missed anything this morning, catch our rebroadcast tonight at 8. If you are listening to that rebroadcast, just keep listening for the Electro Lounge. I'm Melissa Ross. This is First Coast Connect on 89.9 WJCT FM Jacksonville. 1A is up next. We'll be right back here again at 9 a.m. tomorrow for our Friday Media Roundtable. Have a great day and enjoy a little alt country. Have a great day. I'm not immune to get blown apart. She'd like a claymore. That's what she's there for. She's waiting around here to get blown apart. Oh, having her on my brain's like getting hit by a train. She's gonna kill me. I'll select. I'll select. I'll select. I'll
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.